Gilchrist moves over behind Kemp. He goes back to pass again. Runs out to the right.
Still on his feet. Now throws. It's good to Lawson.
At the 10. At the 5. Touchdown! Touchdown!
The John Murphy Show is on the air.
Mario Williams hands him around the waist, and he drops him. Super Mario gets in on the sack party.
Yeah! Let's go, Buffalo! Come on, baby!
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the greatest show in sports.
Ball into the end zone. It is intercepted. It is picked off. Aaron Williams made a leaping interception in the end zone.
Hear all the action, all the excitement of Buffalo Bills football. Right here on
The John Murphy Show.
The John Murphy Show presented by NOCO, supplying natural gas and electricity to thousands of homes and businesses across Western New York. Tonight on the show, we'll take a look back into Bills draft history. Bruce Nicholas was a Bills personnel executive for several years in the 70s and early 80s. We'll talk with him at 7:30. An update on this year's draft from Kevin Weidel of ESPN. And coming up at 8:30, one of the Bills' all-time greats, Reuben Brown, talks about heads-up football. Finds a crease up the middle, dodges the man at the 5, into the end zone, touchdown, Fred Jackson!
Live from One Bills Drive, this is the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Good evening, welcome to Tuesday, the John Murphy Show. I'm eager, I'm ready to go. I want to zip through this show. I think we have a good show tonight. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about Bills history tonight, and we need your participation in that as well. Let me explain it out for you. 7:30 tonight, we're going to talk with a guy I've known for years and years, Bruce Nicholas. He used to be a personnel guy with the Bills back in the Norm Pollum, Chuck Knox era. Worked for the Bills for 7 or 8 years, from the late 70s to the mid-1980s. He was the assistant director of player personnel under Norm Pollum for several of those years. We got talking today. He's going to be on the show at 7:30, but we got talking today about some of the drafts he was involved in those years. The Tom Cousineau year. That was amazing what went down that year. Booker Moore, Jerry Butler, Perry Tuttle, first-round draft pick. Bruce Smith, Andre Reed the same year in 85. Just an amazing slice of Bills history. We're going to talk with Bruce Nicholas about it at 7:30 tonight. But that got us to what our topic of the night is, to get us started anyway, for you on the phone tonight, if you'd like to join us. The lines are open, 803-0550, the number. Toll-free, 1-888-550-2550. You can always reach out and follow us on Twitter as well. But the draft, as you know, just about 3 weeks away, 3 weeks and 2 days away, round one of the NFL draft, May 8th, Thursday night, round one. We got thinking about Bills draft history. There have been some notable busts. There have been some big-time selections as well. And we wanted you to think, what were the best years for the Bills in the draft, and what were some of the worst years for the Bills in the draft? The best years and the worst years. Give us a call. Let us know what you think. 803-0550, the number, or toll-free 1-888-550-2550. I mean, the first thing you look at, I think, one of the first years you think of, is 1985. The Bills got two Hall of Famers in the same year in the draft. That doesn't happen very often. It happens maybe more often than you think, but it doesn't happen a lot. But Bruce Smith, Andre Reed in the same draft class, 1985. Pretty amazing. I think I would put that at the top of my list for the all-time Buffalo Bills draft class, the 1985 season. Bruce Smith with the number one overall pick. Number one overall, Andre Reed down in the fourth round. In between, Derek Burrows, also a first-rounder, a very good cornerback who played a lot. Frank Reich in the third round. Obviously, he has a place in Buffalo Bills history. Mike Hamby, Ron Pitts. I mean, a lot of these guys, a lot of them, most of them made the team in 1985. They weren't very good in 84. That was one reason why. But two Hall of Famers in the first in that draft class for one team, 1985. Got me thinking, how often does that happen? Two Hall of Famers in one draft class for one team. Well, actually, in 1974, the Pittsburgh Steelers had four players who went on to the Hall of Fame in their 1974 draft. Lynn Swann, Jack Lambert, John Stallworth, Mike Webster. Four Hall of Famers in one draft class? Amazing. The Steelers in 70 had a couple, Terry Bradshaw and Mel Blunt. The 1964 Dallas Cowboys had three Hall of Famers in the same draft class. Mel Renfro, Bob Hayes, Roger Staubach. That's pretty good, really good. Two Hall of Famers for some other teams, the Redskins in 1964 with Charlie Taylor and Paul Krause. Cleveland, 1964, same year, Paul Warfield and Leroy Kelly. 65 Bears, Dick Butkus, Gale Sayers. 95 Tampa Bay Bucks, Warren Sapp and Derek Brooks, a couple of Hall of Famers. But the Steelers take the cake with four Hall of Fame players in the same draft year. What are the Bills' best draft classes? I would put the 1985 draft at the top of the list. I really would. Just a sensational draft for the Bills. What are some of the other good drafts that the Bills have had? Well, I mean, I don't know if I'm ranking these yet. I mean, they've had some good drafts, including we're going to leave out last year for now because we don't know how that's going to pan out. But it appears that last year's draft class looks pretty solid when you look at the contributions they got last year. Starters and E.J. Manuel, Robert Woods, Kiko Alonso, Marquise Goodwin played a lot. Big hopes for him down the line. But what were the Bills' best draft classes? Give us a call. Let us know what you think. 803-0550 is the number. I look at the 1971 Bills draft class. Is this too long ago for most of you? I mean, I remember it. I was 14 years old. You may not remember, but maybe you can go back and look at it. 1971, pretty good draft year for the Buffalo Bills. They got J.D. Hill in the first round, a very productive receiver. They got Bruce Jarvis, who played center, contributor. Jim Braxton came that year. Donnie Green. Remember, the electric company came that year. Bob Chandler, all the way down in the seventh round, the wide receiver out of USC. Very good draft class for the Bills, 1971. 1979 is an interesting year, and we'll talk with Bruce Nicholas about this. The Bills draft class that year started out number one overall with Tom Cousineau, who, as you know, never played a down for the Buffalo Bills. But then also in the first round, fifth overall, they got Jerry Butler. Solid pick. They got Fred Smirlus and Jim Haslett in the second round, the two of them. Ken Johnson, who played some defensive line, was a very strong contributor in the 1980s Bills. He came in the fourth round. Jeff Nixon, who had very good years, he came in the fourth round in 1979. Backup quarterback Dan Minucci also was in that class. 1979, a pretty good year, even with Tom Cousineau. Did they whiff on Cousineau? Did they miss? I don't know. We'll talk with Bruce Nicholas about that. He didn't sign here, so it's tough to say. 1969 draft class for the Buffalo Bills, highlighted by a Hall of Famer, obviously, O.J. Simpson. They also got some other players in that, including quarterback James Harris, who played more than a couple of years in the NFL. 1976 draft class, strong year for the Bills. Mario Clark, a fine cornerback, defensive back, Mario Clark in the first round. Ken Jones and Joe Devlin, bookend tackles in the second round. Ben Williams, solid defensive end in the third round. Keith Moody, one of the all-time return men for the Bills, down in the 10th round. You'd have to say the 1976 draft class was a very good year for the Bills. And some of the lesser drafts, I mean, there were some dark years in the 70s. 1974, Reuben Gant, tight end in the first round, didn't do much. Gary Marangi, that's about all they got out of that draft. 1975, a first-rounder linebacker Tom Rude from Nebraska, and second-round linebacker Bob Nelson from Nebraska. Neither one of them amounted to much. Those were the Bills' first two picks in 1975. They did get Roland Hooks in the 1975 draft. 82 is an interesting year. We'll talk with Bruce Nicholas about this. In 1982, just 3 years after getting Jerry Butler, a wide receiver out of Clemson, the Bills in the first round moved up to get Perry Tuttle, wide receiver out of Clemson. Didn't get much out of him. They got a backup quarterback in the second round, Matt Kofler. Eugene Marv, maybe the best draft pick in that class, 1970 or 1982. So, you know, plenty of nominations for the best and the worst draft class in Buffalo Bills history. There was a more recent one, I want to say 2000, which things did not work out that well. Yeah, Eric Flowers draft, Tavarius Tillman, Corey Moore, Avion Black, Sammy Morris, Leif Larson, Drew Haddad, Deshaun Polk. You'd have to say the 2000 was not the Bills draft class finest hour. But give us your thoughts. The worst draft class in Bills history, but maybe more importantly, the best draft class in Buffalo Bills history. I'm going with 1985 to get two Hall of Famers in the same draft class, Bruce Smith and Andre Reed. Give us a call. Let us know what you think. 803-0550 is the number. Toll free. You can reach us at 1-888-550-2550. And if you want, you can tweet in your response. And our Twitter account is at John Murphy Show. Let's see, a couple of them, Kat Hassenauer tweets in, number 85 is the best with the number of players who saw meaningful NFL time plus two Hall of Famers. Yeah, I think 85 is hands down the Bills' best draft class of all time. Chris Gordon tweets in, Bruce and Andre in 85, two Hall of Famers along with Reich, the greatest, or the quarterback of the greatest comeback ever, easily the best. Sal Capaccio, our good pal, says 85, he thinks, let me see if I can go back here. 85, Sal says, but he also says 86 and 87, both pretty darn good as well, according to Sal Capaccio. Let me take a look at those real quick. I think we're all coming to the consensus that 1985 was the Bills' best draft class. 86, Ronnie Harmon, Will Wolford, Leonard Burton, Mark Pike, Butch Roll, Tony Fergenick. I don't know about 86. 87, very good, very strong year. Shane Conlon, Nate Odoms, Roland Mitchell, Jamie Mueller, Leon Seals came in that draft. Keith McKellar, Howard Ballard down in the 11th round. Yeah, don't overlook 87. Very good draft class for the Bills. Give us your calls. Let us know what you think. The Bills' best draft class of all time, and their worst, if you think that's applicable. 803-0550 is the number, or toll-free 1-888-550-2550. Let's go to Bill in Tonawanda. Hi, Bill. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Murph. Love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to throw in one draft class that's known as for bust. It's the Maben one. I know he didn't work out, but we got Wood, Levitre, and Bird in that one.
Yeah.
Yep, thank you.
Good point. Very good point. And that's the thing. I'm asking you tonight to evaluate not just the, you know, the busts or the greatest draft pick in history. You can do that if you want, but look at the whole class in general. And he makes a good point, Bill does. Aaron Maben, number one pick for the Bills in 09, but also in the first round, Eric Wood. In the second round, Jarris Bird and Andy Levitre, followed by Sean Nelson, Nick Harris, Kerry Harris, and Ellis Langster, who is still in the league with the Jets. Pretty good class overall. The Maben pick obviously colors your perception of that draft. That did not work out at all for the Buffalo Bills. The all-time Bills draft class, which is it? 1985, do you think? Do you have a nomination for another one? I mean, you can go back as far as 1960 and 61 and see some interesting draft picks, interesting draft classes for the Buffalo Bills, and the all-time worst draft class in Bills history. 803-0550, the number, or toll-free, 1-888-550-2550. Here's a call from Dave in Florida. Hi, Dave. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. I appreciate it. Sorry to jump off topic a little bit, but I don't get too many opportunities to talk with the Buffalo sportscasters like yourself. I'm really hopeful this year is going to be one of our best years in a long time as far as draft picks go. But what I really want to know is I'd love to just hear your opinion. If the second-best QB in the draft is going to drop to the Bills, do you think that they're going to consider it? Because nobody sold on EJ, and you know they rate a lot of these guys higher than he was rated, and we don't have a legitimate second-string guy. And, I mean, I think it would be really, really hard to pass up if you got a guy, you know, that might be the best or the second best in this draft that falls to you at number 9.
Dave, let me ask you, when you say nobody sold on EJ, who are you talking about? Because there's a couple of rooms full of people upstairs here at One Bills Drive who are sold on him.
Well, I don't think he's proven anything yet. And I'm not saying that he won't. You know, he could turn out to be a great quarterback. I mean, he's shown some good things, and he's shown, you know, some bad things. You know, so I'm really concerned about the knee injuries. With as easily as he went down last year, with just, you know, getting a slight hit out of bounds, that's very concerning.
Yeah, you know, I hear what you're saying. I guess my point is, you may not be sold, I may not be sold, but the guys who are going to pull the trigger on draft picks in 3 weeks are sold on EJ Manuel for this year. They are all in. They've been saying it since January. So to answer your question, would they draft, you know, the second-best quarterback, whoever that might be, at 9 overall? I don't think so. I think they've made that pretty clear. They are not in the market for a quarterback this year, especially not in the first round.
Appreciate it, guys. It's always great to talk to you Buffalonians again. Go
Thanks,
Bills.
Dave. Thank you very much. I mean, that's what I'm telling you. That's what they've said over and over and over again, starting back at the Senior Bowl in January, reiterating that at the Combine, and once again a couple of weeks ago at the NFL meetings in Orlando. They are all in with EJ Manuel. They are not interested in a first-round quarterback. They do have other needs that they want to fill with that first-round pick. That's what they've said so far. Give us a call. Anything you'd like to talk about, including the Bills draft classes. What's the best? Maybe what's the worst? 803-0550 or toll-free 1-888-550-2550. This may take a little research on your part. You don't have to name the year exactly, but maybe name a player or two that came out the same year that you thought were the best Bills draft classes of all time. I'm not, you know, I don't want you to have to do homework to listen to the show tonight. Let's go to Sebastian in Hamburg. Hello, Sebastian. You're on the air.
Hey, Murph. How you doing?
Okay.
I'd have to say the class of 83 was the best class because that's the year we drafted Jim Kelly.
Kelly, obviously, Hall of Famer, was good. Tony Hunter, you recall, came two picks before him, the tight end. Daryl Talley, yep. I think, makes that a very strong class. He was a second-round pick. After that, there wasn't a whole lot there. a wide receiver from Pitt, Julius Dawkins, who played, Trey Junkin, a tight end. There wasn't a whole lot there other than Kelly and Daryl Talley and the Tony Hunter pick. I mean, did he merit the 12th overall selection that year? I don't know. We should ask we got to ask Bruce Nicholas about that, Sebastian. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Justin in Rochester. Hello, Justin. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, buddy?
Okay, buddy.
Very good. Hey, draft class, you're definitely right about the Reed and Bruce Smith class. Absolutely, that's got to be the best or one of the best ever for the Bills. As far as draft strategy, I'd like to see him take a tight end if they could or another offensive player, and that would be great for the Bills moving forward. And I am one of those people who is not in agreement with E.J. Manuel. I'd like to see them get another option for us. The injuries, the inconsistency, it goes into the reasons why the Bills have been as bad as they've been the last 14 years. We don't have a strong quarterback. We need another option there at QB. I just don't want to have his play hold us hostage next year because I think we have a good enough team to at least compete for the playoffs, and I just am not sold on EJ.
Okay, Justin, thanks for your call. I get that, but I will say this. they made a concerted effort a year ago, this time a year ago, longer than a year ago, to do exhaustive research on quarterbacks. They came up with EJ Manuel. EJ played 10 games last year. I think it'd be foolish to expect them to throw all that research out, all that conviction out, everything they did to arrive at E.J. Manuel as their guy, to ask them, to expect them to think that they might chuck that out the window after 10 games that he's played in the league, I think is foolish. I don't think they'll do that. I don't think they should do that. They did their homework on quarterbacks last year. You mentioned it's what's held us back over the years. I'm paraphrasing what you said. You know what's really held the franchise back over the 14-year playoff drought is indecision and going back and forth and switching decision-makers, different GMs, different coaches. Yes, different quarterbacks. Do a study. Who do you like? Which quarterback do you want? Do the research in an exhaustive fashion. That's what they did a year ago. That's what Buddy Nix and Doug Whaley and Doug Marrone and his staff and all the scouts did. They arrived at E.J. Manuel. He only got the 10 games in last year. They got to stick with that conviction. I think it's very important to stick with that conviction that they arrived at a year ago. Are they guaranteed to be right? Absolutely not. But should they, keep drafting quarterbacks every year, trying to find the guy, without any sufficient development time? No, and there is development time. These guys are not finished products coming out. We'll talk with a couple of our guests about this tonight. Very rare that a quarterback in particular is a finished product, ready to go, ready to lead, ready to win in the NFL, coming right out in the draft. And I think to expect that E.J. Manuel with 10 games under his belt would be that guy, I think is unrealistic. Let's go to Tom in Rochester. Hello, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. A couple of points. First, real quick about the draft and then about the quarterback situation as far as for the draft. I would have to say if you're going to go, it depends on what you're looking at to me. If you're going at direct impact on the team, I would have to say 83, Jim Kelly, because look what's been happening since we haven't had a quarterback of Jim Kelly's caliber. We haven't, he single-handedly turned the face, the franchise around with just his face and you knew you were set there, and look what he did the whole time he had been here.
Yeah, so except let me just stop you for a second, Tom. It was an immediate impact. I mean, there was a three-year break between the time he was drafted and the time he played, so that kind of complicates.
Right. I mean, you had to get a couple other key players in there, which is why I'm saying if you wanted to put which draft finished it all off, as you're saying, so then we're going to say the same thing about Bruce Smith and Andre Reed. When they came here, it didn't switch right around either. When it started to actually switch around and make it, was when they got the final pieces of the draft of 87, when they got Will Wolford, they got House Ballard, they got Keith McKellar. Now they had it all set. They had the protection for Kelly. They had the pass down the field because, as we've seen, defenses and they take you so far sometimes, and a wide receiver. But you need that quarterback to get it to that wide receiver, and you need that general on the field to lead that offense to score. So with that in consideration, I think you could have had all those pieces still, but without Jim Kelly, as we've seen, we've had pieces in previous years. We just still haven't had the quarterback. Now, as far as the quarterback goes, where the caller called in and said, take a quarterback at 9, he'd be crazy. The second best, even the first best quarterback in this draft, compared to less previous drafts, would be rated the third or fourth rounder at best. I don't see, there's a lot of hype, of course, about Johnny Manziel, but he's not even going to be, I don't believe in him making it as a franchise quarterback in this league. So if you think he's your number one, no. Bridgewater, seen his inaccuracy at his pro day, No. I would have rated him, and even Mayock said would have rated him below Geno Smith last year if he came out, which Geno Smith was only probably, you know, went in the second round. So you got to look at that. There's no way you're taking one at nine. None of these guys, the first best one is even worth the first rounder, in my opinion, this year.
All right, thanks. And other people have a different opinion, Tom. I don't know if you noticed just last week, I believe it was, that Charlie Casserly mentioned that he thought that E.J. Manuel would be the eighth best quarterback in this year's draft, which I thought was absurd. But that was Charlie Casserly's evaluation. You know, Johnny Manziel, we've talked about him a lot. We'll talk about him a lot more in the next 3 weeks. There is a very good piece on Yahoo.com written by NFL Films senior producer Greg Cosell. We've had Greg Cosell on the show, and it just went up yesterday. He spells out exactly what the issues are with Johnny Manziel from a technical sense, but more from a team approach sense. Basically, and I really would highly recommend this article. It's on Yahoo.com, Greg Cosell. Basically, he says, if you want Johnny Manziel, you got to look at him as either a Drew Brees type or a Russell Wilson type because of his physical limitations. Both Drew Brees and Russell Wilson are shorter, not of big stature, not big arms, big NFL arms, and Brees and Wilson are both very effective. Wilson, Cosell points out, because he's surrounded by that outstanding Seattle defense. Brees, as Cosell points out, because he's got some weapons on offense, but he's got amazing quick delivery and a really good head on his shoulders, essentially. Greg Cosell spells it out much better than I can. Go to Yahoo.com. To me, it's sort of the definitive statement on Johnny Manziel and how a scout would be looking at Johnny Manziel. Take a few more phone calls here on the topic of the Bills' best draft class, maybe the worst draft class. Tom in Springville. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Hello, are you there, Tom?
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
Good. I just want to say I'm all in with DJ, too. I don't know what's up with half these callers. And I got to say, last year's draft, I think, was one of our best. We got four starters out of it.
Yeah, I mean, last year's draft, it's pretty early to evaluate, but I like what they did. I like the way it played out. I mean, what will happen, Tom, in a year where there's a coaching turnover like there was for the Bills last year? They will draft players and play them right away. The new coach will. The new coaching staff will. That happens a lot, very frequently. And a lot of that is because the coaching staff, they are committed to these players, not the players who came in the previous regime. So, which is not to say anything poor about those four players who contributed a lot last year. I think there's amazing potential here. And if you look at last year's draft, if E.J. Manuel becomes the quarterback that some people think he can be, you've already got Woods, Alonzo, contributors. Marquise Goodwin, a contributor, and he needs to stay healthy. Duke Williams gets a chance to play this year. It's early to say, but I do think there are some intriguing possibilities in last year's draft class. Let's go to Craig in his car. Hi, Craig. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I haven't looked anything up because I'm driving, but yeah. I think our worst draft has to be the year we pick Walt Podolsky as the number one overall pick in the draft.
Yeah, what is that, 70?
72 or?
Let me go back. I've got to scroll down here. I think you're right. It might have been 72. Number one overall pick, Walt Podolsky. Yeah, that was a tough one, 72. Now, that was not a good pick. Also in that draft was Reggie McKenzie in the second round. So that you got to think about that a little bit. But you're right. That Reggie McKenzie was like the only player of note in the rest of that draft. I'm looking, Bob Penciana, guard. Nobody else played that long. Maurice Tyler, defensive back, played for like 6 years. Walt Podolsky was on the show with us a couple of years ago. He's back in Buffalo. I don't know if you knew that. He's back in Buffalo, Craig. Yeah, he does business here in Buffalo. Really good guy. And we talked to him. He was on the show with us, I want to say, 2 summers ago. We talked to him about being drafted number one overall, the pressures that put on him, and his NFL career. He's a really good guy, and it's good that he's back in Buffalo. I think he lives down on the waterfront somewhere. Good to have him back in town, though. Thanks for your call. We'll talk more about this, and we're going to talk a lot about Bills draft history coming up in a moment. We're going to talk with Bruce Nicholas. You may not remember the name, but he played a prominent role in the Bills personnel department under Norm Pollum through the late 70s and early 1980s. Bruce Nicholas was the Buffalo Bills assistant director of player personnel during that period. He's going to be live on the line with us to talk about some of those drafts, some of those decisions, and some of those players that the Bills got in that period. A look back into Bills draft history as we approach the 2014 draft. Got a lot more to come. The John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. Live tonight from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Talking a lot about the draft coming up just in 3 weeks, the NFL draft. And besides looking forward, want to look back a little bit. We've done that in the first half hour of the show, the Bills all-time draft class. Got us thinking. The thing that got us thinking about that was our next guest, who I've known for several years. He's a former scouting assistant for the Bills who became the assistant director of player personnel under Norm Pollum. Bruce Nicholas with the Bills from 1979 through 1985, a seven-year tenure, and he remains here in Western New York, and he joins us live on the line. Hello, Bruce. How are you tonight?
Hey, Murph, how are you?
Great. Thank you very much for being with us tonight. You actually jogged my memory about some great days gone by and some memorable draft days for the Buffalo Bills. But I want to talk about your back. You came to the Bills, but your background really was with the New York Jets, right? Your dad used to work with the Jets.
Yeah, both my father and my uncle were the team physicians for the Jets. And I went to graduate work at the University of Massachusetts. And when Norm Pollum and Chuck Knox came here, they were looking for somebody to kind of run the scouting office, and they wound up hiring me, and that's where I came here back in 78.
It was a different era back then, wasn't it? A guy could get a job like that right out of college, I would think. That might be difficult to do now.
Yeah, it was different. And back then, I was the computer, basically, because we didn't do a whole lot of computer work. Everything that came in the office basically, you know, wound up coming across my desk at some point. So it's a lot different than now.
What would happen back then? The scouts would be out in the field. They would, what, phone in their reports, and somebody would have to transcribe it?
No, they would send in the reports. And for a time period, we wound up being in our own little combine with three of the four following teams, the Seahawks, Cowboys, 49ers, Broncos. Four of us together, different teams at different times, wound up sharing information that our scouts would go visit, and we'd share information. The problem was that sometimes not everybody shared the information. And we'd be looking for certain reports, and we'd have to call Gil Brandt, and, oh, yeah, it's coming, it's coming. And sometimes we wouldn't get it on time. So we took that combine for a while, and ultimately we, you know, we lasted 4 years in that, and we went back to more realistic endeavors.
Hey, Bruce, it's worth noting that part of your football pedigree, your sister, Connie, was an NFL scout, right? The first female scout in the NFL.
Yes. She worked for the Jets for many years in the early 80s. She did a lot of scouting, and she had a hand in the Gastineau pick and others, and so there's a lot of Nicholas people running around the NFL for a while.
Yeah, we're with Bruce Nicholas, former Bills personnel man, the assistant director of player personnel from 1979 through 1985. As you said, you came here with Norm Pollum and Chuck Knox, both of whom came from the Los Angeles Rams, both of whom brought pretty big, outsized reputations with them. They were true blue football guys, weren't they, Knox and Pollum?
Oh, absolutely. Norm was almost a father figure to me starting out here. And Norm was one of the few people that could talk to Chuck Knox and convince him of things. Other than that, Chuck ruled with a pretty heavy hand.
What was it? I can't remember who he had on the show a couple of months ago talking about I know who it was. It was Greg Gabriel. You probably remember Greg. He talked about the influence that Norm Pollum had on him. He was like a football guy's football guy, wasn't he, Norm Pollum?
You know, yeah, he was. He was, absolutely. And Greg himself was kind of the equivalent of a gym rat, only in the football field. And he would always be around, and we wound up having him grade film for us. And then he wound up moving through the ranks for the Giants, and then Blesto, and then ultimately as the Bears personnel director. And Norm Pollum really gave him his chance, and he shined.
Hey, Bruce, let's talk about some of those early drafts that you were involved in. And let's start. It's an interesting year, 1979, because the Bills had the first overall pick. And tell me how the team settled on Tom Cousineau. And tell me, was there any rumbling, any inkling that he might not want to sign with the Bills?
There was no rumbling at the time. We fully expected we'd be able to sign him. And Cousineau was the guy. There really wasn't a lot of discussion. Actually, Jerry Butler was another person that we were considering at number one, which we wound up taking with, I think, the fifth overall pick that year. We had two ones with Cousineau and Jerry Butler. We wound up coming back with Freddie Smirlis and Jim Haslett, both in the second round, and then some guys that were spot players for years, like John Borchardt and Kenny Johnson, Jeff Nixon, Rod Cush. And Nixon, by the way, really had his career cut short by injury. He probably would have been a top player.
Jeff Nixon had that great rookie year for the Bills, or maybe it was his second year when he had all those interceptions early on. But if you even setting aside Cousineau, that's a solid draft class, isn't it, when you talk about Butler, Smirlis, Haslett, and the other guys that you mentioned, Ken Johnson in particular.
Well, it was, and it was a great beginning for us in 79 to get, you know, four or five really good players like that. And then Cousineau, ultimately, even though he did not sign with us, we were able to trade the rights then later and come up with players. So it really was a beneficial draft. The problem was that subsequent ones weren't as good.
Hey, Bruce, do you think, in, you know, benefit of, you know, what, almost 30-plus years of hindsight, had Cousineau signed with the Bills, come here, played, would he had a good NFL career? Because, or did he lose his way, do you think, going to the CFL, to Montreal, and then finally coming back to Cleveland?
No way of really knowing, but I suspect that if he really had it in him to be the kind of player we thought he'd be, he probably would have been that once he came back with Cleveland, and he never really got off the ground. So I kind of have my doubts about that.
Yeah. And actually, he did work. It did work out to the Bills' benefit, right? Because eventually, the Bills traded Cousineau's rights to Cleveland, and that's how they got Jim Kelly.
That's right, exactly.
We're with Bruce Nicholas, former Bills personnel, assistant personnel person, talking about some of those drafts he was involved in with the Bills in the late 1970s and early 1980s. One draft that strikes me also, Bruce, is the 1980 draft. Jim Richer, offensive lineman, 16th overall, followed by Joe Cribbs in the second round. That's a good 1-2 punch for any offense, huh?
You know, that's one of the few drafts out of the seven we did that the night before, when Norm and I talked about it, kind of figured that that might be the order and the two guys we'd be looking at. And that's probably the only time in those 7 years where it kind of worked out like that. And then we picked up Mark Bramer in the third round and then Greg Cater, who punted for us later in the draft. But yeah, again, the problem was you had a few middle rounders, early rounders like Gene Bradley and John Schmetting, and that didn't turn out. And then when you start to get a few drafts in a row where some of the players, your high picks, don't turn out and you don't supplement it with a lot of surprises down lower, you wind up showing the misses 2 or 3 years later. Yeah. When you start losing more,
they start to catch up with you. Tell me the story of Booker Moore, first pick for the Bills in 1981, and it never really panned out. Tell me how that all worked out, Bruce.
Booker Moore was a real in-between guy, a little bit small for fullback, not quite really fast for running back, but very productive, comes from a good program at Penn State. Chuck Knox loved him. And when it came time to pick, we were looking at Booker and Chris Collinsworth. And we debated over that for a while, but Chuck really wanted to get the fullback in there. At that time, we had a pretty good receiving crew, so he wanted Booker. So I go to pick Booker up at the airport. We had just given him a physical 3 weeks before, and there was nothing detected in any way. When I picked him up at the airport, I went to shake his hand, he fell down the steps of the airport, and I thought some people thought I pushed him, but by the time I got down there and helped him up, he was really shaking. And so we wound up obviously getting him looked at, and it turned out he had Guillain-Barré syndrome, which meant about a year of rest, and they felt he should come back strong, but he'd have to rest. And so he sat out his rookie year, and I believe when he came back, being an in-betweener, he lost that little edge, and he wound up bouncing around for a couple of years, and then he was out of football. Super guy. It might have been a good back, but that disease, that illness, may have robbed him of that little edge he had.
And Guillain-Barré, I actually was doing some research on it today. It's like a neurological disorder. Some people think it comes about if you get the flu sometimes, right?
That's my understanding. And it floored us at the time because we did not see anything in the physical just weeks before. But he lost a lot of lung numbness in his limbs, and he, like you said, he fell right down the steps of the airport.
Amazing.
That's how fast it came on.
Amazing. And obviously that colors that draft class, right? I mean, you got when your first pick can't even play the first year with an undisclosed illness like that, that really affects the way you look at that 1981 draft.
A lot. But what hurt more was the follow-up. Byron Franklin, Mike Mosley, Robert Holt, three wide receivers we took in the second, third, and I think maybe sixth round. And all three didn't turn out to be players at the time. We wound up trading Byron Franklin a few years later for Pete Metzlars. So at least we got something out of that,
yeah.
Something pretty good. But we didn't get much out of that 81 draft. Rob Riddick and Justin Cross were both late rounders, and they both contributed quite a bit for a few years.
Yeah. The following year, the Bills went receiver. And I'm curious the relation between Perry Tuttle and Jerry Butler, who came 3 years earlier from the same school, Clemson. So you have success with Butler, who was good right out of the box in his rookie year in 1979. Now 3 years later, another Clemson receiver, Perry Tuttle, becomes the Bills' first pick. Tell me how that came about.
We did not believe Perry Tuttle would last past the fifth or sixth pick, and as the draft began to unfold, and we knew what certain teams wanted, it became apparent that he might be around in the middle of that first round. At that point, we thought about having the smooth, long strider, Jerry Butler, great hands, and then the quick, darting Perry Tuttle. So we thought it would be a pretty good combination. But to do that, we had to move ahead of Philadelphia. And at that point, Chuck Knox was pretty tight with Dick Vermeil in Philadelphia. We knew they wanted a wide receiver. So we wound up jumping two notches ahead of them by making a trade with Denver. And when we took Perry Tuttle, we were ecstatic at the time. And he came to camp, and he ran about 1,500 slower than what he had run previously. Ran like a high 4.68, 4.7. Struggled, hurt his fingers the first week of camp, broke a finger, if I remember correctly, and really played maybe 2 years sparingly, wound up going up to Canada and was out of football. In the meantime, Philadelphia, who was really upset that we jumped ahead to take him, had to settle for Mike Quick. And, of course, you know, Mike Quick went on and became a Pro Bowler for 4, 5, 6 years.
Yeah, pretty good
so
stuff.
So you never know quite what you're getting. Sometimes it backfires, you know?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's the nature of the draft. There's one more draft I want to ask you about. We're almost running out of time here, Bruce. But you were here in 83, right, when the Bills went to Tony Hunter at 12 and then Jim Kelly two picks later, right, the famous quarterback draft.
Yes, exactly.
Tell me why Hunter ahead of Kelly that year.
People fell in love with Tony Hunter. He was charismatic. On top of being a pretty good football player at Notre Dame with good hands and a tight end, maybe being a game changer, he had that charisma and he was intelligent. But when he came here, he really didn't play very well. I don't know if he was really tough enough at that time. And so we took Hunter and we knew we would get a quarterback after that. And we wound up taking Kelly. Of course, before that, you know, Blackledge is gone and Elway. And then after that, Easton, O'Brien, and Marino.
Yeah, Marino's still on the board, but I read somewhere where Norm Pollum was just sold on Jim Kelly, right? That was his guy.
Yeah, Norm loves Jim Kelly.
Yeah. Bruce, does it occur to you that scouting may have been simpler then, but it's still not an exact science? I mean, with all the resources teams have now, they still make mistakes in the draft, don't they?
Well, I think what you hear sometimes on NFL Network and ESPN and all that, I think it's true that people do overthink. I think the more time you have to analyze, you do get paralyzed a bit, and you second-guess yourself. There wasn't quite that exposure back then, so we didn't have to worry about that. We made our picks, we lived with it, and some were good and some were bad. And you never know reasons why people don't make it, and you don't know what's going on in the draft room, whether the head coach is making the pick or the personnel director. And frankly, I have to say, Ralph was great. Ralph never meddled, suggested, demanded, or anything like that. He was highly involved, and he listened to everybody, but he was just a wonderful owner and just a wonderful guy. He was self-deprecating. He was intelligent, wonderful guy. But he never interfered with any draft picks in the 7 years I was there.
Yeah. People love the draft, Bruce, maybe now more than ever, and we love getting a chance to talk with you about it and talk about some of the Bills' draft classes of years gone by. Thanks a lot for doing this tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Murph. Anytime.
Okay, Bruce Nicholas, former Bills Assistant Director of Player Personnel, spent 7 years in that draft room with the great Norm Pollum, Chuck Knox there as well, and an assortment of other coaches and general managers. Our thanks to Bruce for joining us tonight. We've got more to come this hour. It is the John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. We're live at One Bills Drive on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Is the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Thanks again to Bruce Nicholas. Really good perspective on the draft. I think the thing he said at the end was absolutely right about the, you know, there are hits in the draft, there are misses in the draft. It's always the way it is, always the way it's going to be. I'm paraphrasing what he said. But back then, when he was involved, 79 through 85, there was so much less attention focused on the draft that, you know, it wasn't that big a deal. You knew that you would miss some and hit some. Interesting stuff. Thanks again to Bruce Nicholas. Those are some good days. We've been talking a lot tonight about historical drafts, the Bills' all-time drafts. James Renfro tweets in, 64 draft for the Bills. Carl Eller, Hall of Fame. Paul Warfield, Hall of Fame. Butch Bird, Pete Gogolak, all drafted by the Bills. Pretty good, huh? Yeah, really good. I guess I skipped over that because neither Eller nor Warfield played here, but yeah, they were Hall of Famers, obviously, in the NFL. Carl Eller for Minnesota, Warfield for the Cleveland Browns and Miami Dolphins. But Yeah, you put those two. The Bills drafted him, so they'd have to go under consideration as the Bills, one of the Bills' best all-time drafts. Going to talk about the 2014 draft when we return. Going to talk to our pal Kevin Weidel from ESPN, and you can phone in your comments and questions. You got quarterback questions, phone them in. We're going to focus on wide receivers primarily, but Kevin Weidel joins us live when we return. The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO, live tonight from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
Is over. We're back with more of the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO.
You can't stop CJ Spiller. You can't stop him. How did he do it? How did he do it?
Let's go sometime.
Hey, hold hands. Let's go. Check it out.
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO, supplying natural gas and electricity to thousands of homes and businesses across Western New York. Everybody's on their feet in the stands. This crowd is absolutely whipped into a frenzy.
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Hour two of the show, Reuben Brown's going to join us at 8:30 tonight to talk about his involvement in the Heads Up football program with USA Football. Reuben Brown at 8:30 tonight. Talking a lot about the draft, and we spent the first hour of the show talking about the draft from a historical sense with Bruce Nicholas, former Bills Assistant Director of Player Personnel. We had the phones open for your thoughts on the Bills' all-time best and worst draft classes. We continue to talk about the draft, but now the focus turns to the 2014 draft, 3 weeks and 2 days away. Joining us on the line, a frequent visitor, our go-to guy in the draft these days. He is a college football and NFL draft analyst for ESPN, former quarterback at Indiana University in Pennsylvania. He worked in the NFL with the Jets scouting department, and he's been with Scouts, Inc. since 2007. He works with Todd McShay at ESPN. Our friend Kevin Weidel on the line with us. Hi, Kevin. How are you tonight?
Doing well, Murph. It's just a never-ending process, you know, this time of year.
It definitely is, and it's a couple of weeks longer this year. We might want to invite our listeners, if you have comments or questions for Kevin about specific players in the draft, prospects in the draft, your favorite player, what's the latest on them, where can they go? The phone lines are open, 803-0550 or toll-free, 1-888-550-2550. Kevin Weidel from ESPN on the line with us. Hey, Kevin, we spent a lot of time this last hour talking with the former Bills personnel guy, Bruce Nicholas, who worked for the Bills in the late 70s and early 1980s. And he talked about how much more sophisticated the scouting process is, the drafting process now, but still mistakes are made. He said the difference now is your mistakes are magnified because there's so much attention on the draft, both before and after the draft. I think that's true, don't you, if you compare the draft now to even 15, 20 years ago?
Yeah, I think there's less patience. You know, I think either, 10, 15 years ago, you had a general manager in, there's a couple-year plan see play out and process play out with a 2-3 year plan. I think people want to win right away, and owners are becoming less and less patient, and the pressure comes on, and they want to see at least improvement each year. So it's always crucial that you draft well, and I'm always a full firm believer that you build your team through the draft, and the successful organizations do a great job doing that. You don't win in the offseason, you just win through the draft. So, the teams that can dig in and evaluate these players and get to know them and really not only get them to know them on tape, know what they're looking at on tape, but get them to break them down character-wise and how they're built inside in between the ears and how they fit in their teams. The ones that can find the fits and the hard workers are the teams that really you see every year having success.
With that in mind, Kevin, when you think about everybody wants to build through the draft, and you talked about the impatience on the part of owners and fans for that matter, can teams afford to draft somebody knowing that there's development time built in? And I think about this specifically in terms of the Bills and quarterback E.J. Manuel. Very rarely does a quarterback come out as a rookie and play right away and excel right away. Can teams still afford to say, we're going to draft this guy, he may not be where we wanted to be the first year, but in a year or two, maybe even three, we're going to have a really good player? Can they even afford to look at a prospect like that anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. If you believe that he can develop and he shows signs of improvement, I think, each year, I think it's a positive sign. Obviously, quarterbacks are playing more and more. I mean, it's the norm now. When you draft a rookie quarterback, you expect it to come in and play right away. So I really think you need to do a good job of developing them. And I think more so than anything, this day and age, since the quarterbacks are expected to play right away, you have to be prepared in terms of what you're surrounding him with. I think a perfect example is up there in Seattle with Russell Wilson. Now, Russell Wilson did a great job this year. I'm taking nothing away from him, but he also came into a very favorable situation, a team that was able to run the football and a team that played great defense. And I think that's the formula in terms of bringing a quarterback in and not asking him to do too much early on as he develops, and just making sure you have enough parts around him early on to kind of keep the pressure off him and let him develop on his own. So that's the key area for me, I think, when you bring a quarterback in. You better have the right personnel around him.
One more thing before we get into specifics, and I want to talk to you about wide receivers tonight, Kevin, but I don't know if you happened to read Greg Cosell's analysis of Johnny Manziel came out, I think, just yesterday. And he talked about Russell Wilson and Drew Brees. And essentially, Greg Cosell wrote that if you want to draft Johnny Manziel, you got to believe that you either put him in a situation like Russell Wilson with a strong defense and a good running game, so you're not asking him to win games by himself, or like Drew Brees, and then you have to believe that he's got the head on his shoulders like Drew Brees. I don't know if you saw that article, but I think he's – I mean, there's talent there with Johnny Manziel. You've called him the most, volatile, the most – what do you call him? You've never
He is the biggest wild card in this draft.
Yeah, he is.
He's unconventional.
Right.
And, compared to Russell Wilson, Drew Brees, I just think his style is different than those two. You know, Johnny Football wants to be Johnny Football, exactly that name. He wants to go out and make, his tendency is to go out and create on his own with his feet, and he'll make big plays and he'll manufacture big mistakes as well. So you got to take the good with the bad with him. To me, I just think it's a big leap of faith with Manziel. And I look at it, you know, I came up with an analysis. I look at it like a big hand of poker, you know. Someone's raising the ante and another guy's calling. I'm going to fold and sit this one out and let it play out. And I'm going to pray to God that no one in my division drafts him. Because whether he lasts or not, I know for a year or two, he's going to be a big pain in my rear end. So that's the way I would approach Johnny Manziel. I just kind of fold and let the process play out with him.
We're live on the line with Kevin Weidel. He is an NFL draft analyst for ESPN. You can phone in your comments and questions, 803-0550, the number, or toll-free, 1-888-550-2550. A couple of weeks ago, Kevin, you wrote that in the 8 years that you've been evaluating draft classes, the wide receiver crop this year is the deepest that you can remember. That's saying a lot, I think.
Yeah, it is. You had 19 underclassmen declare this year, which is making, you know, really bolstering the depth and the strength of this class. I mean, you look at the top 16 of our wide receivers ranked, 14 of them are underclassmen. So it is a very deep class. There is a wide variety that come in all shapes and sizes, and a lot of different fits. So it's the team trying to figure out what they're looking for and where they can get, you know, which prospect fits their mold and their scheme the right way and at what value they want to get them. But there is plenty to find. And I think more so than ever, you're going to find receivers in fourth and fifth round that normally, in normal years, you wouldn't even have a chance at him at that point in the draft.
I want to get back to these receivers in a second, Kevin, but we did get a tweet in for you from Greg Torlone who says, Clowney and Mack far and away the top defensive ends, but where does a guy like Coney Ealy fall? Who's got defensive end high on their board? What do you think?
Well, you know, I think with Coney Ealy, you look at him, he's a guy that's going to add some pass rushing help. I think he's more of a second rounder. I know a lot of projections have him in the first round. To me, he's more of a pass rushing specialist. I think he's a little finesse against the run. I think he needs to get stronger. You don't see a lot of aggression, kind of the Anthony Barr type player. But this guy's more finesse. But the one thing he does have is versatility as a pass rusher. He can play outside with two-point stance with his hand in dirt. You can reduce him inside, Murph. And I think today's day and age with the NFL, you're seeing more and more defensive coordinators with different schemes and a variety of personnel. I think he's the type of guy that you can move, has the flexibility to move around that defensive line and kind of create some mismatches. So that's where I think his strength and his value is going to come in. I think in the second round range, a team like Jacksonville could be an option. Tennessee, obviously Denver looking to bolster, help on the defensive line and even Oakland. So, you know, certainly there's teams to be there, but I think right in the second round, I know a lot of people have him in the first, but to me, I think he's more of a day two type prospect.
Kevin Weidel from ESPN, draft analyst on the line. And let's, I'm going to bounce, I apologize for bouncing around, but back to the wide receivers. You mentioned the variety of wide receivers this year. There's big guys, there's speed guys. Is there any room? I mean, people never even refer to possession receivers anymore. Do those guys even exist anymore, Kevin?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I think in this draft, I think one of the biggest ones in the hottest name right now is Cody Lattimore out of Indiana. 6'2" and a half, 215 pounds. Clocked in at a 4.47, you know, 39-inch vertical. And we watch him on tape, really good route runner. And, you know, you just don't see a ton of separation. But he's the type of guy that consistently has the wins in contested situations. I think he's got the strength. I didn't see him. He's got great hands. I didn't see him drop a ball in the five games we studied him. Reminds me a lot of Akeem Nicks out of the New York Giants. To me, I think he'd be an absolutely great fit for Buffalo in the second round range. You know, they were bottom near the bottom of the league converting third downs. This is the type of player, the type of receiver I think they need with the size and the strength to go up and win those contested situations and move the chain. So I think Lattimore's a really good fit up there in Buffalo. You can get him right there in that second round range.
Let's talk about the big guys for a second here. We've obviously talked a lot over the weeks about Mike Evans, but what about some of the other big wide receivers? Can I just throw a couple of names at you? Jordan Matthews from Vanderbilt. What do you think of him, Kevin?
I like him. I think he's kind of in the third round range in this class. You know, 6'3", you know, 212 pounds. Another guy that's very tough. He's got big hands. He goes up and catches the ball. Questions I have is he's a little bit segmented with his route running. He doesn't always create a ton of separation, so that's the area, and he doesn't provide much after the catch. So, you know, Matthews is another one of those possession-type receivers that can play outside the hashes, has the versatility to bump inside, a guy that's absolutely fearless over the middle, will lay his body on the line. You watch the old Miss tape. I mean, he takes some shots and holds on to the football. So, to me, Jordan Matthews, I think right in that third-round range, you're looking for him in that target area.
A lot of people like Calvin Benjamin of FSU. What do you think of him?
I think he's a genetic freak. I think he's a power forward in pads, Murph. 6'5", 240. The big concerns I have is he's got some inconsistencies catching the football. You know, he's not a guy that's going to he's not a very polished route runner, not a guy that's not going to create a ton of separation. His separation is going to be late with the ball in the air, kind of the Alshon Jeffrey mold. Except I thought Alshon Jeffrey was a little bit more fluid than Benjamin was coming out of school. Out of South Carolina, I should say. I think there's big risk and there's big reward with Benjamin. I think I'd feel a lot more comfortable than taking him on the second round than I would in the first round. And I also think you better have a pretty good complement to him to kind of take some attention away because he's a guy that could thrive in one-on-one coverage. There's no question about it. You watch the Florida tape, he shows you what he can do in that game on that tape. He's absolutely dominant. Makes catches down the field over defenders, runs through defenders for touchdowns. So that's one of his better tapes, but there's also tapes where you got some concern with some big-time drops. So to me, a lot of big risk-reward with Kelvin Benjamin.
What can you tell us about Clemson guy Martavis Bryant? He fits into that mold of a big receiver, right?
Yeah, he is, and he's interesting. Man, he is 6'4", 211 pounds, clocked in at the 4.42 range. He's got fluid, flexible, loose hips. He can flat-out fly, Murph. But I think you got to be careful with him. I think, you know, there's a lot of upside, and he's got a lot of intrigue to him. But to me, I think he's more of a number three vertical complement, if you will. I compare him a lot to the late Chris Henry out of the Bengals. That type of role I think he would thrive in. You know, Henry was that vertical complement to Chad Johnson and T.J. Houshmandzadeh in the late 2000s there. I think a team like San Francisco, who's got six picks within the first 100 selections in this year's draft, a team that's got a guy like Crabtree and Bolden, I think Bryant would thrive in that type of role as the vertical complement there to those two. So I think you better be careful where you take him. To me, I think third, fourth round range, I expect him to go higher, but I think if a team's going to draft him higher, expecting him to come in and be a number two option right away, I think they're going to be a little disappointed with him.
You know, we've skipped right over Mike Evans of Texas A&M because we've talked about him a lot with you, Kevin, but is he, I mean, I see his name up there now, you know, first half of the first round in many mock drafts. Is Mike Evans a legitimate number one receiver for an NFL team?
I wouldn't go as far as number one. I think he can develop into it. I think he's more of a number two, you know, a nice complement, a big physical receiver on the outside. You know, there's some concern. Some people think he's, you know, takes a while to get in and out of his breaks. But the one thing he does have is that size, that leaping ability at 6'5", 231 pounds, 35-inch arms. So, I mean, he's got a very wide catching radius. This guy has a problem with the ball in the air. To me, you wonder about the ability to create separation. I've talked to a few coaches that doesn't think he runs very good routes. But at the same time, you just can't find that type of body, that type of build, and that type of player that can create such a mismatch downfield that you're seeing more and more in the NFL, these bigger receivers that are just creating nightmares for defensive coordinators in jump ball situations.
And before we move on to the other class of wide receivers, are there any other big wide receivers worth mentioning that, you know, maybe interest the Buffalo Bills, would you think, Kevin?
I think a guy maybe like Allen Robinson, who at 6'3", 220 pounds, is very raw. You know, he clocked into the 4'6 range, but he's got some explosive leaping ability. I think he verticaled around 40 inches at his pro day. He's a guy, to me, that I just think he's going to be a better pro than he is a college player. Once he gets some coaching and developmenting with his route running, he's very underrated after the catch, and he's got some of that pit bull to him. What I mean by that is that ability to go up and attack the football with the ball in the air. So Allen Robinson, maybe in that third-round range, could be another option Buffalo might take a look at.
Okay, Allen Robinson of Penn State. Now, let me switch gears for a second while we talk to Kevin Waddle about receivers and maybe some of the speed guys. We're going to skip over Sammy Watkins. He's acknowledged number one. I don't hear a whole lot about Marquise Lee, although I think he probably still belongs in the first round, right, the guy from Southern Cal?
Yeah, I think he's fringe first-round range, Murph. And the one thing you got to be concerned, and I think this is a tale for everyone to learn last year, is with the guy out of Cal right now, and I can't remember, Keenan Allen, excuse me, you know, he had a knee injury, didn't run well, but he turned out to be a really good player for San Diego's rookie season. Marquise Lee, same type of deal, dealing with a knee injury, wasn't 100%. I don't think he was as explosive as he was the 2 years before, and I think that had to do a lot with, you know, the knee and ankle injury kind of nicked up. The drops. He had some drops this year, some uncharacteristic drops that were really concerning in his hands. That's the one thing I have concerns with him at this point, but I still think he's in that, you know, top 50, 40 overall range, and I think he could come in and really surprise some people after a kind of a disappointing last season there at USC.
When you read this draft stuff as much as I do, Kevin, every once in a while I'll even take a look at some video, not nearly as much as you do, but I see Odell Beckham Jr. from LSU, his name kind of creeping up. His draft stock seems to be improving when it comes to receivers.
Yeah, he's another guy that thinks he's going to be a better pro than he was college player, and you just saw the improvement from him throughout the 2013 season. From the TCU game, the first game of the year, you watch it there, and then you go and watch the Alabama game late in the season. This guy improved his awareness. I thought he caught the ball better. He improved his route running. Now you look at him at just under 6 foot, 200 pounds, clocked in at a 4.43. This guy's smooth, and he's explosive at the same time. He provides you with some big playability, not only after the catch, but in the return game. And I've talked to a few coaches and scouts in the league who had close ties to the greatest show on turf. I don't even remember that, Murph. In the late 1990s,
yeah,
early 2000s, they say Odell Beckham Jr. reminds them a lot of a young Isaac Bruce coming out. So I thought that was a very intriguing and interesting comparison when you look at him, just in terms of the smoothness, the speed, and the explosiveness he shows out of his breaks. I think Odell Beckham Jr. has a chance to be one of the better wide receivers in this class when we look back on it 2-3 years down the road.
Hey, Kevin, give us a name or two of receivers that no one really is talking much about that you think has a chance to be really good in the NFL.
I'll tell you a guy who I think is a kind of my sleeper in the mid-rounds, and you're looking at an Alabama Kevin Norwood at 6'2", 198 pounds. The thing you like about him, he catches the ball very natural. He caught my eye down at the Senior Bowl. I thought he was one of the better sets of hands. You go back and you watch his tape, and all this guy does for Alabama is make big plays in critical moments and in big games for them throughout his career. He is a guy that goes up and wins consistently in traffic over defenders. To me, I think, and he's smart. He's very intelligent, great field awareness in terms of reading coverages on the run, using sight adjustment, knowing how to set up defenders. I think if he gets into the right situation with a team like the Denver Broncos or a team like the New England Patriots, who rely so much on intelligence from receivers in terms of being in the right position, reading coverages, and breaking off routes, I think he could really thrive and develop into a very good, I think, number three, number four potential receiver that could come out and have a very long career at the next level.
Draft strategy question for you here, Kevin. Does the Bills' acquisition of Mike Williams change their approach going into the draft? I think you kind of wrote about that, right? The teams after free agency, and I mean, Mike Williams was a late free agent signing. They sometimes have to alter what they're looking at.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of, you know, it changes their need and doesn't put they have options. What they're doing with getting Mike Williams is giving themselves options. They don't need to go out and necessarily get a receiver or a guy like, you know, Evans or a guy like Ebron, you know, right away. Maybe they don't feel Ebron's worth it at nine. You know, Evans might not be there at nine, and maybe they don't feel like a guy like Eric Ebron's worth it at nine. Now they can wait and get another weapon maybe in the second round and take a guy, you know, like a Matthews, the tight out of the tackle out of Texas A&M, or something, maybe the best player available that they think on their board that really can come in and help them. So I think with Williams, more so than anything, it provides them with more options at number nine.
As far as receivers, I know, as you said, it's a deep draft for receivers, but when you look at the draft board and who else might need a receiver, I mean, somebody's going to jump on Sammy Watkins, obviously, but is there anybody else ahead of the Bills who, you know, really desperately needs a receiver? I mean, Baltimore's behind him. The Jets are behind him in the first round. Detroit's one pick after him. Is there anybody who's going to, if the Bills have their eye on a receiver, anybody going to jump up and take it right before them and break their hearts?
Well, you know, there's options. I mean, Oakland certainly sitting there at number five. You know, they need a receiver bad. Do they go quarterback? Or do they take a receiver at that point? You know, I wouldn't rule out Sammy Watkins going to St. Louis at number two. You know, he's the type of guy that they need in that type of division with that defense that he can come in and be a big difference maker and kind of help them close the gap between the Seattle and the San Francisco. Jacksonville Jaguars. You know, I think they're going to go, you know, defensive end. They're looking QB more than anything at that point. So I would say Oakland, St. Louis at this point, and then just looking at the rest, I just don't see it after that. But there's always a chance a team to jump up and get a guy. If Watkins falls a little bit, I really expect someone to cut it loose and try to get up and get him because I think he's that special of a talent. I don't think he's in the Calvin Johnson A.J. Green mold, but I do think he's right there at the next tier. As you're talking to Julio Jones, is I think right there is that type of player that Sammy Watkins is.
Hey, one more question for you, Kevin. This goes to quarterbacks. Is it just me, or do I detect that the stock of a couple of previously unheralded quarterbacks is really taking a spike? I'm thinking about Pittsburgh's Tom Savage and even LSU's Zach Mettenberger, both of whom now are getting a lot of attention in the quarterback class. Are they not?
I think the tension for Tom Savage is worth it. I really do, John. The more I watch his tape, the more I think he translates to the next level. You know, I could go into a long story just to give you the short version. He hasn't had more than a year at one place under a system. He transferred from Rutgers, went out to Arizona. Rich Rodriguez took the head coaching job, and he's had to sit out for 2 years before going to play at Pitt his final year. I watch his tape, and I see a guy that is tough. I see a guy that played behind an awful offensive line that took an absolute beating. But you know what? He sat in. He stared down the gun barrel. He delivers some throws that no quarterback in this class can make on tape. The arm talent is special. I think he's the type of guy that can be worked with and developed at the next level. And he's more nimble than people give him credit for, and he's got more pocket awareness. So Tom Savage, to me, I think he's worth the day two pick. I wouldn't go necessarily too early on him, but I'm talking about a developmental guy that I think can turn into a starter relatively quickly in this league 2-3 years down the road with the right development. Zach Mettenberger, to me, I just can't get on board. I have struggle. I see the size. I see the arm talent, but he lacks mobility, number one, and he's not very poised under pressure. Decision-making really dips. His clock kind of speeds up, and he makes some hurried decisions. So When you don't handle pressure well cerebrally and you don't have the mobility, I really think you're going to struggle at the next level. So to me, Tom Savage is warranted. I just can't get on board with Zach Mettenberger.
We always learn a lot when you have you on the show, Kevin. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Anytime, John. Take care.
Kevin Weidel, he is an NFL draft analyst for ESPN. He joins us on a regular basis now as the countdown to the draft continues 3 weeks and 2 days away, round one of the NFL draft on Thursday, May 8th. Speaking of drafts, the NHL entry draft, the draft lottery held tonight, and the Florida Panthers win the draft lottery. The Sabres will pick second. Got more to come. When we return, it'll be Reuben Brown on the line with us to talk about his involvement in the Heads Up football campaign. The John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. Live tonight from One Bills Drive, this is Buffalo Bills Radio.
More of the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Thanks again to Kevin Weidel. We kept him for a long time, but he's got great information, very strong opinions. You heard him talk about the quarterbacks, Zach Mettenberger, et cetera. And thanks to Kevin Weidel for joining us to talk about the NFL draft. We're going to make contact with Reuben Brown, the 9-time Pro Bowl performer for the Buffalo Bills, in a moment or two, and talk with him about his involvement in the USA Football Heads Up football program, an effort to prevent concussions and other serious injuries. We talked a lot tonight about the draft, both past and present, current draft. Past draft, we asked your thoughts on the all-time draft class in Buffalo Bills history. We threw out a couple of years out there, including 1985, when the Bills had two Hall of Famers in that class. We got your phone calls on that. We got a tweet from Daryl Talley, who knows a thing or two about these things. Deciding factor, Canton. So that leads us to believe that Daryl Talley believes the 85 draft class with Bruce Smith and Andre Reed was the Bills' all-time draft class. I think Daryl was in one of them in 1983 with Jim Kelly, one of the better draft classes in Bills' history. But good to hear from Daryl Talley. The all-time draft class, he thinks, was 1985 with those two Hall of Famers in the draft. We can continue that discussion as we wait for Reuben Brown. Hope to have Reuben on the line with us very shortly. I want to remind you, as we talk about the draft, the Bills and M&T Bank have the Predict the Drafts or Predict the Picks draft contest underway right now. One fan is going to win with an exclusive meet and greet with the Bills' first pick. You can go to buffalobills.com/predict the picks, and you're going to be asked a series of 10 multiple-choice questions all about the Bills' 2014 draft. Now, the contest runs through May 7th, the day before the draft, and the NFL draft starts the next day. The fans who correctly answer 80% or more of the questions go into the contest grand prize, which is are entered to win the contest grand prize, which is a meet and greet with the Bills' first pick in the draft this year. And 50 fans who answer at least half the questions correctly will get an official Bills draft cap by New Era Cap. Go to buffalobills.com/predict the picks by 11:59 p.m. Wednesday, May 7th, the day before the draft. You can go to buffalobills.com for all the information. The Bills and M&T Bank with the Predict the Picks 2014 draft contest. It is up right now at buffalobills.com. One of the Bills' great draft picks came in 1994 in the first round when they went to University of Pittsburgh and chose offensive lineman Reuben Brown. He spent 9 years with the Bills. He went to the Pro Bowl 9 times, and he's still involved with football, still a Western New Yorker. Reuben Brown joins us live on the line right now. Reuben, how are you tonight?
I'm doing fine, Murphy. How are you?
I'm doing great. Hey, thanks for coming on with us. There's a number of things to talk with you about, including Heads Up Football, but we'd be remiss if we didn't congratulate you on being on the ballot, a nominee anyway, for the College Football Hall of Fame. That's new this year. You've never been on that ballot before, have you?
No, I've never been on that ballot, and I never thought I would be, and it's just an honor. I'm going to just act like I'm in the Hall of Fame now.
Good idea. I see, Shane Conlon's on that ballot as well, and a couple of other Bills notables, but we wish you well on that. I guess the voting is in May. I'm sure you're going to get a lot of consideration for that, so that's good news. Reuben, you've been involved for the last couple of weeks now in USA Football's Heads Up Football program as a master trainer. Tell me what that's all about, Reuben. How did you get involved in this?
You know, actually, came about it because I wanted to help out my local youth football programs in Virginia. They were suffering just based on the numbers were dwindling, and the coaches were probably not caught up to speed to today's modern football game. So I started calling around to see different ways that I could help the program, and I started talking to the people over at USA Football. And they told me about the Heads Up program and that they were looking for former players to come and help them with the message of, you know, the different safeties and new standards they're trying to create for young players. and I liked it. And so I went out there to Indianapolis and met up with all the heads of USA Football, and I became a master trainer in the heads of football program.
So in Indianapolis, they sort of educated you on some of these issues, right, on concussion prevention, et cetera, that sort of thing?
Yes, they told us a lot of the different protocols that they want to use or implement into the youth football programs, because a lot of things are disjointed, you know, and a lot of terminology and language, as you know, all teams use their own language or their own style or thing. But that can be complicated when it comes to, you know, dealing with young kids, their first experience to football at a young age and learning how to be a football player and how to be safe in it. I really like the part of the program that's really trying to bring in the mothers and the people that care for the kids, like drive them to school, to the programs all the time, so they're more educated about their kids participating in football.
You know, and it's funny, the heads up football is sort of named exactly for one of the techniques, isn't it? When you talk about proper tackling technique, don't they teach kids, teach even pros, to keep your head up, to see your target, to avoid concussions, right?
Yeah, it's all about the main focus on the techniques in the program is trying to tell kids not to use their head to tackle. You know, the head's up, your head should always be up so you can see where you're going. When your head's down, only thing you can see is your feet or the opponent's feet. And you're at a vulnerable position with your head down. The crown of your head is exposed, and that's the most vital part of your body when you're playing a collision sport. You want to protect the top of your head. And, you know, keeping your head up is a natural thing to say, but really the program is telling all the kids to not tackle and go in with your head. There's a proper technique to use that doesn't have to involve the head.
So as a master trainer, Ruben, what will your role be now moving forward after you've been certified by USA Football?
Oh, now I get to put the stamp of approval on the coaches and the personal safety trainers that are in our leagues. I am directly involved in certifying coaches that will be in the league, people that sign up. And we want to encourage all the coaches that are in football to join this, because the main thing, the NFL, USA Football, NCAA, professional trainers, athletic trainers, everyone has come together to kind of bring a consensus on the practices of running or teaching young players how to be involved in football and a lot of steps, from tackling to hydrating, what to eat, you know, how to prepare to go out on the field before you actually put pads on, what you're doing. You know, there's a lot of training steps that they want to, you know, get out to the public so we can have our players play the game safer.
Well, I mean, you got to give credit to the youth football coaches who are out there, Ruben, guys and women, I'm sure, who are not paid for, I'm sure they're not paid at all, and yet they give up a lot of time and effort to do this, and it's important, I think, that they're trained correctly, that, you know, it's fine to be old school, but you got to be aware of things like concussion prevention and preparedness for heat and hydration. That's critical when you're dealing with young kids, right?
Yes. I mean, it's someone's child that you're dealing with when you're a young a youth coach, and I commend all of those guys. Good Lord. I mean, the coach that had to deal with me when I was a young child out there playing on the field, I mean, he should have a medal. He should be in the Hall of Fame, you know?
Yeah. That's how Mark Levy made it in the Hall of Fame.
Exactly, you know, to deal with us and be able to do that. And in order to be in that position like Mark Levy, you had to be knowledgeable of a lot of different factors about this game. You want your players to enjoy the game, number one, and you can only enjoy the game if they're out there playing it safe. And if they're playing it safe, it gives them an opportunity to play it more and not be injured.
Well, there must be demand for it, Ruben. I saw some numbers that a year ago there were 27 master trainers around the country like yourself. This year there are 70, so it's almost triple the number of master trainers who are ready to go out there and spread the word about heads-up football.
Yeah, and, you know, the whole idea is to make heads-up football the standard. It's like people say Pop Warner, and you know what that is. You know Pop Warner is youth football program or whatever. Well, we want it to be now where heads-up football means the standard of what everyone's doing when it comes to youth football. And everyone will know the terminology. Every family around the country can relate. Oh, yeah, we do it this way in our town, too. You know, my kid is being taught the same safe practices and the same safe protocol is taken every town and every state that they're playing football.
On the line with former Bills offensive lineman Reuben Brown, who is a master trainer for USA Football's Heads Up Football program. Before we let you go, Reuben, we want to give you a chance to talk about your annual motorcycle run and car show, which is coming up Saturday, June 21st here in Buffalo in Western New York. How many years have you been doing that, Reuben?
Man, you know, I keep forgetting. I think it's 13, 14 years now. This thing has been a love-hate relationship. But, you know, I keep getting a wonderful group of people to come out and support it. And this year we're raising money for the Eden Chopper class. And these kids are near and dear to my heart because they love motorcycles and engines like I do. It's an after-school program that a fellow motorcycle rider runs that teaches kids to build custom motorcycles, and they've gone around the country and won several awards for their motorcycle builds that they've done. This year's bike is an awesome diesel engine motorcycle, which everyone's got to come out and see, and it's done by high school kids. So we're inspiring mechanics and as well as athletes.
Well, it's a great cause, Reuben, and again, to remind people that it is Saturday, June 21st, right here in Orchard Park, Reuben Brown's Motorcycle Run and Car Show, and if you need more information on that, you can go to reubenbrownfoundation.com. Reuben, congratulations on USA Football being a master trainer. That's good work, and we hope to talk to you about it again soon in the future. Thank you.
Yeah, we definitely will. We'll talk about plenty more, Murph. I'm good hearing from you.
All right, thanks. Reuben Brown, 9-time Pro Bowl performer on the offensive line for the Bills and the Chicago Bears. He is a master trainer for USA Football's Heads Up Football program. You can get more information on that at usafootball.com. More to come, the John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. Live tonight from One Bills Drive, this is Buffalo Bills Radio.
Is the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Thanks again to Reuben Brown, and good for him getting involved with the USA Football's Heads Up Football program, a master trainer for Heads Up Football. We had a good night tonight. We talked a lot about the draft. If you were tuned in about the hockey draft, the Sabres are going to pick second in the hockey draft. Florida Panthers win the draft lottery, and updates on that coming up a little bit later on tonight, obviously. We're talking NFL draft a lot tonight, and we'll continue to do that tomorrow night as well here on the John Murphy Show. We talked a lot about the all-time draft in Buffalo Bills history, and I guess the consensus is the 1985 Bills draft was the all-time draft because, quite frankly, because of the two Hall of Famers in there, Bruce Smith and Andre Reed, both coming in 1985. Hard to argue with that. Very good draft. Very good draft here. Bruce Smith in the first round. Andre Reed in the fourth round. Very good cornerback. Derek Burrow's involved. Frank Reich in the third round. Some other guys who played for the Bills, including Mike Hamby, defensive lineman, played a little bit. Hal Garner played some linebacker. Chris Burkett played some wide receiver. I think that is one of the best Bills drafts. You know, the 1979 draft, I think, was very good for the Bills as well, even with Tom Cousineau being the number one pick and never playing a down for the Buffalo Bills with guys like Jerry Butler, Red Smirlis, Jim Haslett, and others. So, yeah, some interesting thoughts on the Bills draft from a historical perspective. And this shocked me. I guess I must have come across this. I thought, how many times has a team drafted two Hall of Famers the same year? The Bills did it, obviously, in 85. It has happened before, though. The Pittsburgh Steelers drafted four in 1974. Lynn Swann, Jack Lambert, John Stallworth, and Mike Webster. The Dallas Cowboys drafted three in 1964. Mel Renfro, Bob Hayes, and Roger Staubach. And then other teams have drafted two in the same year. But it doesn't happen that often. I thought it was I thought it was pretty interesting. There's a quick call here from John in Buffalo. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, John. I hate to veer off away from this because I actually called about the NHL.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Sorry about that. Now, we're not talking about the NHL draft. We're talking about the NFL draft. We've talked about it a lot tonight. By the way, I understand the interest in the Sabres, but there's no comparison in the draft. I mean, the coverage, and I'm not talking just in Buffalo, but nationwide, right? I mean, the hockey draft is, are there many people paying that much attention to guys who don't play for several years? I'm not trying to knock NHL hockey, but the draft doesn't compare in terms of the impact on teams, in terms of the history, in terms of the attention and focus. I mean, it's not even a cottage industry. It's a major industry now following the NFL draft leading up to the draft. We do it every night here with a variety of draft experts. So I get it. I mean, the Sabres are going to pick second. Florida's going to pick first. Tomorrow night, we'll talk more about what else? The draft here on the show. We're also going to talk with about an effort by the NFL, a study done by the NFL on female fans, female spectators, and what they are looking for when they follow the National Football League. Dr. C. Keith Harrison from the University of Central Florida, among our guests tomorrow night to talk about his study. He and his group at Central Florida did a survey on female fans following the NFL, what they are looking for, what they want to see, what they'd like to see more of in terms of the stadium amenities, in terms of coverage on television. We'll talk with him about that, along with NFL Draft Talk tomorrow night on the show. We're on the air from 7 to 9 tomorrow night. We want to thank our presenting sponsor tonight, NOCO, family-owned and locally operated since 1933. Explore what NOCO can do for you at NOCO.com. We want to thank our guests tonight, including Bruce Nicholas, Kevin Weidel, and, of course, Reuben Brown a moment ago. Our engineer is T.J. Luckman. Our producer is Jay Harris. And the Bills Director of Broadcasting is Jeff Matthews. See you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, with another edition, two-hour live show, The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO from One Bills Drive on Buffalo Bills Radio.